Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
What can you do when your friends get sick of you prying into their problems?
Do what everyone else is doing, of course. Start a podcast.
Introducing If I Speak, a brand new podcast from me, Ash Sarkar.
And me, Moya Lothian-McLean, where we pitch each other our big theories about the universe, share the intrusive thoughts keeping us up at night, and best of all, tackle your personal dilemmas.
We'll be asking questions like, does tabloid gossip turn us all into conspiracy theorists?
Should you financially support a parent?
Is Moya turning into a bit of a femcel?
Yes. What's Ash's most toxic trait?
Interrupting. From dating disorders to family feuds, career dilemmas to online etiquette.
The political gets personal on If I Speak.
Find us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's gossip elevated.
Welcome to Intelligence Squared. I'm Head of Programming, Connor Boyle. For this episode, we're looking back through history to the era of Mary Stuart, better known as Mary, Queen of Scots. The 16th century Scottish monarch story, one that involves pageantry, plot twists, imprisonment, and her eventual demise, is the background setting for a new novel from Flora Carr, The Tower. Carr's writing has appeared in numerous newspapers and magazines, but The Tower is her first novel harnessing the power of the imagination amid a real historical tale. Joining Flora in conversation for this episode is writer Francesca Peacock, who listeners may remember from her appearance on this podcast to discuss her book, Pure Wit, about another historical figure, Margaret Cavendish. Let's join Francesca now with more.
Flora Carr was named one of the 40 London Library Emerging Writers in 2020/2021. She won the Vogue Talent Contest and was shortlisted for the 2018 V.S. Pritchett Short Story Prize. Her work has appeared in Time magazine, British Elle, Radio Times and The Observer New Review. The Tower, which I've got a copy of here, is her first novel. I'm so excited to have the chance to talk to you about The Tower. I so loved reading it with its rich mix of historical details and also such a vividly imagined drama.
Thank you.
It felt to me like a sister to a novel by Hilary Mantel or some of Maggie O'Farrell's historical fiction. But for listeners who haven't read it yet or don't know much about its central character, Mary Stuart, Mary Queen of Scots, could you tell us a bit more about Mary, Mary's life and the months that The Tower fictionalises?
Yeah, of course. Oh, where to start with that question? So the months that it fictionalises. So the book, which is literary feminist historical fiction, it begins in 1567 and it follows a young pregnant Mary, Queen of Scots, after she's imprisoned in an island fortress in the middle of a vast loch, Loch Leven. Mary Stuart, otherwise known as Mary, Queen of Scots, her life is very well documented, I would say. She's probably best known for the events at the end of her life and also her long captivity in England on the orders of her cousin Elizabeth I. But my book sort of charts a 11-month sliver of time in her life, which I feel has been sort of underserved in terms of representation in her life. I attended an otherwise amazing exhibition at the British Library, a retrospective on her life and Elizabeth I's life. And I remember going in and looking for whether there'd be any references to this period of time, to Loch Leven. And I could only find a sort of one-line summary of this very eventful, impactful, pivotal time in her life, her captivity there. And the empty space when it came to that was really the jumping off point for me, the fact that I had never heard of that period in her life before.
Yeah, so it's rooted in real history, and the four women who are in the tower, which your novel takes its name from, are Mary herself, her two chambermaids, Jane and Cuckoo, and Lady Mary Seton. All of whom are real historical women, yeah. But you also litter your writing with other women from the period. One of my favourite mentions is Lady Mary Sidney, the mother to a woman who appeared in my own research for her psalm translations. So I wanted to ask, what was the research process like for writing a work of historical fiction? And how did you start to decide to write the book and to balance the type of history needed with the more imagined fictional side?
Yeah, in terms of research, firstly, I should preface all of this by saying that I am not a historian. I think all fiction writers are hugely indebted to historians such as yourself. A lot of my research was I began with just reading everything that I could get my hands on, biographies of Mary Stuart, books about the time period. I also listened to academic podcasts, watch documentaries. I'm a member of the London Library, so that was amazing in terms of access to online and physical resources. And then I think also I'm someone who's very much inspired by place. So I visited Edinburgh and I visited Lochleven twice. The first time was just before I started writing, and I really wanted to get a sense of the atmosphere, and really it was a sort of deciding point as to whether or not I wanted to write this book. And I decided to write the books off the back of that first trip, which I found hugely inspiring. And then the second trip, when I was finally able to access the island and the ruins of Lochleven Castle, by this strange twist of fate, the boat that carried us across from the shore to the island was actually called Mary Seton, who you mentioned before in your introduction, who is one of the ladies-in-waiting to Mary Stuart and is probably sort of well known as one of the four Marys, one of four noble women who served Mary Stuart, who all sort of coincidentally were called Mary, as many women of this period, as I'm sure you found in your research.
My favourite statistic is sometimes you can find books where more Marys are mentioned or articles than men, which is a lovely reversal effect of the statistic, where there are more CEOs called John than there are women. So you went to go visit this castle, and in your book, it's a really bleak place. It's a horrible place where Mary had been taken, and she's taken there in part, without spoiling too much, she's also forced to abdicate because of her religion. She's a Catholic, while Scotland has newly become Protestant. And one of my favourite lines in the book comes from when you are describing this difficulty. You write that the lords, the Scottish lords, wanted a powerful leader who was also a dutiful wife, a woman who was sexless yet fertile, a brood mare who was also impermeable. In short, they were ex-Catholics who demanded their queen embody all the impossibilities of the Virgin Mary. You sum up so neatly there, such a potent mix of misogyny and religious differences. But could you explain a bit about how that really plays into the background of your novel and how you chose to represent Mary's Catholicism?
Yeah, so I think in terms of the reasons for why she was forced to abdicate, I completely agree that her religion certainly played a very key part to the reason why the rebel Scottish lords didn't warm to her. But I also think that her gender played a huge role, and also the fact that so at the beginning of my book, Mary is just 24 years old. She turns 25 during the course of the novel, and during that period of time, there was a law which stated that once a sovereign turned 25 in Scotland, they would be able to redistribute sort of land and property, which would have been a huge headache for many of the Scottish lords who had previously rebelled against her and sort of developed a difficult relationship with her. For example, Lord Lindsay, who I sort of mentioned, who appears very early on in the book, he certainly would have been stripped of many of the perks of him being a lord.
Yeah, so she's so young and so maligned, as you rightly say. Yeah, and she's pregnant. She's had, I think, three husbands by this point. I don't think we can really imagine how difficult that all was, and how how bleak this period was in her life and the lives of the woman she was locked up with. It isn't just religion, is it, which causes a slight difficulty. I find it really interesting that Mary's son, who she's had by this point, goes on to become James I of England, James VI of Scotland. He is terrified of witches, but there's also a story that in part his birth was aided by witchcraft. Could you talk a bit about that and what it meant in this period?
Yeah, so I had no idea about this. I think it's just an extraordinary irony that this monarch, who became, his name almost became a byword in terms of witch hunts, was actually born via the aid of a spell. So Mary Stuart, she had an extremely difficult childbirth with James, and she enlisted the help of, I think it was the Countess of Atholl, to place a spell to try and ease the pains of labour, and then James was born. So I thought that was extraordinary. I'm so glad that you picked up on that little detail.
Yeah, and she also has a relic brought to her, doesn't she? Like the exhumed head of St. Margaret. It's so interesting to think of childbirth as something which was potentially so dangerous in the period and so tied to so many different spiritual beliefs.
I think sometimes historical fiction writers, when they're writing about real life people, sometimes they can be asked the questions of, well, how do you feel about writing about someone who really existed and also writing about someone's very real pain? And I think when it came to writing the, without going too much into spoilers, there's quite a traumatic sort of miscarriage in the book. And I found that I really wanted to give that moment sort of space and sort of the time that it deserved. Because as I say, when I had read about sort of summaries of that period in Mary Stuart's life, the events that she went through were very much sort of, I don't want to say glossed over, but very neatly encapsulated. And there was nothing really about the kind of the dual trauma of miscarriage and then being forced to abdicate only sort of a matter of days afterwards.
I suppose there's a sense in which through fiction we can kind of access a version of these stories which we can't often access through history. If there are no sources on it, we have to be so much more faithful. There's a way in which your fiction kind of fills in a gap in a really lovely way.
Thank you. I think with Hilary Mantel's Wreath Lectures, which I adored, she talked about how the sort of erasures and the gaps within history. As an aspiring historian, when she initially came across those, she found them quite sort of difficult to deal with. But then she talked about how those erasures helped make her a novelist. And I definitely think I feel similarly. And also I feel more specifically that there has always been a great deal of erasure when it comes to women's stories and LGBTQ stories. And I think fiction is a really useful tool in terms of sort of trying to imagine those stories.
Yeah, these gaps are kind of more gendered and tell of aspects of history which haven't necessarily always been thought of as fit studies for history. What I really like about your book is there's a really strong current of sex running the whole way through, which I think is not an overstatement to say, but there's just a lot of it going on, and some of it's pleasurable, some of it's desirable, people have crushes, there's a really thick sense of tension within the tower. But going back to childbirth, there's also something which I found incredibly interesting, and I'd come across before in like research into kind of early modern sexuality and stuff, but you mentioned the doctrine that a woman had to be in pleasure to conceive a child so that no child could be produced by rape.
Yeah.
It's a crazily misogynistic idea, and one which was, you know, talked about in this period, continued into the 17th century. How did you come across that? And do you get affected the way you wrote about women and sex in the book?
Yeah, I found that fact absolutely extraordinary. No, I can't remember off the top of my head where I heard it. It might have been on the very excellent podcast Not Just the Tudors, which is hosted by Professor Susanna Lipscomb, and which I'm a huge fan of. But yes, so many of sort of viewers might be familiar with Mary Stuart's third marriage to the Earl of Bothwell, and their relationship I contend, began with sexual assault. And I just found it extraordinary, this idea, because Mary Stuart, again, I it's a conjecture, but she became pregnant quite quickly. And this idea that a woman needs to be in pleasure in order to conceive is just hugely, like a really dreadful concept when you think about it. I'm really glad that you picked up on that.
We make a lot of stuff here at Intelligence Squared. So many great chats to enrich the mind, like the one you're listening to now. But like any business, it's really essential to be in good shape and keep things efficient so you can see the big picture all in one place. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. With NetSuite, you can cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems, and it's super easy to get started because NetSuite exists in the cloud, so no hardware needed, cutting your IT costs too. And you'll also improve efficiency by bringing all your major processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. That's why over 37,000 companies have already made the move. The cost of living crisis might not be making anything any cheaper, but there's real value in feeling on top of things, which is something I experience firsthand as an event producer every day. And now, by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared. netsuite.com/squared. Intelligence Squared is a tight-knit team doing big things, and it means we're always looking for tools that can help streamline managing tasks. That's why I want to talk to you for a minute about NetSuite. NetSuite provides cloud-based software to get things moving. Maybe your business has been humming, but you can feel things are falling behind a little bit. Or perhaps your team is getting snowed with manual tasks and closing those books is taking forever. If this sounds like you, you should know these three numbers. 37,000, 25, 1. 37,000, that's the number of businesses which have upgraded to NetSuite by Oracle. 25, NetSuite turns 25 this year. That's 25 years of helping businesses do more with less, allowing them to close their books in days, not weeks, and drive down costs. And one, because your business is one of a kind, so you get a customized solution for all of your KPIs in one efficient system with one source of truth. It means you can manage risk, get reliable forecasts, and improve margins. It's everything you need to grow all in one place. NetSuite is now making an unprecedented offer to make more of that kind of thing possible. Right now, you can download NetSuite's popular KPI checklist designed to give you consistently excellent performance absolutely free at netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared to get your own KPI checklist. netsuite.com/squared. Sponsoring the show for this episode is Marquee TV. Marquee TV is a streaming service with a difference. It's bringing you the top tier of performing arts straight into your living room or onto your device. So think dance, theatre, music, anything you might find in the West End, Broadway, or maybe a cool little experimental space too, but saving you the cost of a few tickets as well. I've got happily a bit lost in their vast library of performances, exclusive interviews, and behind-the-scenes content. Choreographer Jonathan Watkins' interpretation of George Orwell's classic 1984 was pretty cool, and I love the dance piece, Sutra, inspired by the skills of Buddhist Shaolin monks. And we've got a special treat for our listeners. Marquee TV offers 3 months of access for just 99 cents. That's right, 3 months for only 99 cents. With the code SQUARED, simply visit marquee.tv and use the promo code SQUARED to dive into the world of arts like never before. Bring the arts home with Marquee TV.
Yeah, it's a kind of doctrine which means that if a woman was raped, then no child could be produced. And if a child was produced, then it kind of makes the argument that it wasn't rape, for example. It's also an argument which pops up in different circumstances where people say that prostitutes have two slippery wombs to conceive by virtue of being prostitutes or something. It's very odd, and I think it ties into this kind of early modern, very late medieval ideas of history of medicine and sexuality, which, you know, have deeper roots and stretch far further than we might otherwise think, I think. It's all very interesting. And another area of medical history which came up in your book, it comes up for very different reasons, is the belief that each person is made up of four humours,
and Lady Seaton, jokingly called Saint Seaton by some of the other people in your book, believes that she might be a medical aberration. She is attracted to women rather than men. I wanted to ask whether that really was the case and how you'd found that, and how important you thought it is to explore queer histories and stories which might have been forgotten.
Yes, I'm trying to remember the exact book which I found that in, but so essentially with humoral theory, which I'm sure you're very familiar with your work, the idea that so men are hot, women are cold, they're sort of a number of sort of key central humours, and there are ideas in which, so if someone is ill, for example, the idea is that their humours are imbalanced. And I came across a reference to the idea that women who had same-sex desires potentially were too hot, that they had too much of the sort of male humours within them, and vice versa. Which I just found really interesting. I found that the whole idea of that very, very interesting, and the idea that one has to sort of balance oneself in order to be well. It's not a huge, huge leap from some of the ideas that come up today in sort of holistic medicine and things like that.
Yeah, and so it leads to this kind of moment of same-sex attraction between Lady Seaton and one of the chambermaids. Could you talk a bit about the tensions between these four women? We know for a fact that they were in the tower for that long and what kind of circumstances they were living under. In your book, it's a kind of smelly, horrible world of being locked inside a couple of rooms.
Yeah. I certainly think that lockdown was very inspirational in terms of being able to imagine that kind of sense of claustrophobia and sort of people being on top of one another. And yeah, I think so. The relationship between the four women is so important, because another one of the reasons I really wanted to write this book was because I feel like Mary Stuart's story has been for a very long time defined by her relationships with men. Mm-hmm. So like John Knox, her half-brother, the Earl of Moray, her three husbands. And I really wanted to take the opportunity to kind of reframe her story through the lens of sort of female friendships and all the complexities that entails, because they are very much sort of, as you kind of allude to, there are power dynamics that sort of change and shift throughout the course of the book. And I was really interested in looking at how that would play out in the sort of the inner lives of the four women, and the sort of petty jealousies and the sort of the love and the lust and the hate and all of those emotions that sort of spring up through the course of the book.
Yeah, because Mary has been taken away from her kind of more traditional, to use a very modern phrase, like support structure. She is away from, I think you call her like golden ladies or her jeweled ladies or something.
Yes,
she's with women of a different class to her, who otherwise wouldn't have that type of proximity to her. And there's such a kind of really interesting idea that for these men, they can't quite believe that a woman has so much power as queen of Scotland. But for these women, they're very aware and keyed into Mary's power. There are some brilliant passages where you describe her chambermaids touching her body and not quite believing that is the body of a queen.
Yeah, because in the book there are two chambermaids and then one lady in waiting. And as you say, the kind of the social divisions between the women over the course of the book, they begin to blur. And I think in terms of the physical touch of the queen, I think it can't be sort of overstated how important that would have been in it, and sort of how revered that access would have been during this period of time. Touching the queen, some people believe that it would sort of cure their ailments. And I think there's this real dichotomy that the women sort of, as these chambermaids have more and more access to Mary, they come up against this idea where they've revered her for all this time, but as they spend more time with her, there's also, they push up against this idea that she is just a a person, the royal person is still a body at the end of the day with all those normal bodily functions.
Yeah, and I think the moment where that really comes into quite sharp focus as the difference between being a royal woman and a royal man is childbirth. I mean, she is in such danger. It's really pushing the limits to working out that a queen is also a human with a body.
Yeah, exactly. As I said, like I really wanted to give the sort of the birthing scene the proper sort of space that it deserved, because I do really think that childbirth was sort of the equivalent of the battleground when it came to this period. Infant mortality was so high. It was such a dangerous period for a woman to be in, both sort of during childbirth and after. The risk of infection was really high. So yeah, I really wanted for the reader to understand the kind of drama and the life and death sort of stakes of that scene.
Yeah. It's a book with a lot of drama in it. There are escape attempts, very sprained ankles, jumping out of windows. What also struck me is kind of, it's going to sound weird, but how papery a book it was, how much depended on letters being smuggled in and diplomats being able to get things to Mary via spies and people trying to help her escape. So I found that incredibly interesting, and it kind of, I think, adds to a real air of drama. But what I also found incredibly interesting was you mentioned that Mary used to write her own poetry and had found it tough in the tower. Is that a fictionalization? She did write her own poetry, but do you know if she was writing in the tower? And did you have a chance to read any of her own work?
That is a sort of speculation on my part. Obviously, the famous casket letters, which sort of helped bring Mary Stuart down, I wanted to sort of vaguely allude to those. But yeah, she did write poetry during her lifetime. I think she was a very creative person. She had a lot of hobbies as a sovereign. She did dancing. She played golf. She loved animals. She wrote in French, which I'm not fluent in, but I've read translations and also looked at physical copies of her work, and I find I enjoyed sort of looking at her handwriting, and if you compare it to Elizabeth I's handwriting, which is sort of dashed across the page, so very italics, and then when you look at Mary's, it's a very confident, sort of round. One imagines that if she were living in sort of present day, she might write almost in sort of bubble handwriting. but I love that you brought up sort of the issue of letters and the importance of that, because I think one of the things that really appealed to me about Mary is that I think the reason that she continues to appeal to so many people for so long is because she remains an enigma and a person of contradictions. And I think that's due in a large part to the fact that for a huge chunk of her life, basically from this point, the sort of 1567 onwards, she was forced to communicate in half-truths and coded messages, often in sort of in ciphers, in letters.
Yeah, so she kind of exists through codes, both real and ideas that we only ever really hear what other people think or thought of her. You know, she's either a traitor, a Catholic, or on some occasions a whore. So kind of living through different archetypes, yeah.
But there is that binary of Elizabeth I is the virgin and Mary Stuart is the whore. I came up against that a lot when I was doing my wider reading around Mary, and I think it just speaks to the misogyny of the time and the way in which we sort of pigeonhole women.
Yeah,
because I say Mary was a very multifaceted and contradictory person.
Yeah, I wanted to ask about the relationship between Mary and Elizabeth. Elizabeth at this point is Queen of England. She is refusing to marry. So she becomes this kind of foil almost for Mary in Scotland, who is married three times. But at this point, early on in your book, there isn't necessarily that much animosity between them. Elizabeth tells Mary that an abdication under duress is not an abdication at all. So there's kind of a degree of help between them. They call each other their fellow princes and cousins. But that obviously sours as Mary's life goes on. So very interesting. That relationship is fascinating. Could you talk a bit about what happens after the end of your book, maybe?
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to veer too much into spoilers as to when, at what point the book ends. But there is an eventual escape. As you say, that this period in Mary's life was extremely action-packed, which is another reason why I'm confused as to why there hasn't been like a bit a movie about this period of her life. But anyway, she does manage to escape, but she is again defeated by the rebel Scottish lords, and she flees to England, and against the advice of some of her friends, because if she had fled to France, for example, she was a dowager queen there, she could have been accorded the sanctuary that she sought. I think there are various reasons why she didn't do that. Potentially the sort of animosity between herself and her mother-in-law, Catherine de Medici, might have played into that. But yes, she does flee to England. And I think many of your viewers will know the rest of the story, that she was in captivity for a very long period of her life, from the age of, I think she might, yes, 25. But I think in terms of her relationship with Elizabeth, as you say, at the beginning of the book, there isn't that sort of obvious animosity. And in fact, I think if Elizabeth hadn't spoken out in support of Mary during this exact period of time when Mary was imprisoned at Lochleven, she may well have lost her life during that captivity. I think the fact that Elizabeth spoke out in support of her, and I assume as well there was an element of self-preservation, it sets a very dangerous precedent for a group of men to be able to kill an anointed queen. But yeah, she did speak out against Mary's imprisonment, and I think ultimately that saved Mary's life at quite a pivotal moment in time.
Yeah, I think it's so interesting. I think the comparisons drawn between them, as you say, are often too binary, and there's obviously quite an interesting relationship there, where they obviously feel as female princes a kind of a kinship between them and what the world expects of them. So we have touched on this already. You mentioned that COVID was a kind of a way of exploring the claustrophobia. I wanted to ask, did you write it during lockdown?
No, so I think it was during the pandemic. It wasn't during the first sort of wave of lockdowns. It wasn't in 2020 that I started researching the book. I began researching, I think, I'm trying to get my head around timings. Maybe it was right at the end of 2020. Certainly I had done a great deal of research by the time that I visited Lochleven in sort of early-ish 2021. Certainly there were still restrictions in place when I first visited Lochleven, because I wasn't able to access the island by boat. So I had to, I remember pacing back and forth, sort of round and round the edge of the loch, like sort of peering at the ruins and the sort of little island. I'd really recommend going. It's such an incredible space to be in. The loch is far more vast than I anticipated, and there are these huge hills of surrounding the loch, and I think in the book I say it's almost like a giant sleeping on one side. They're these sort of huge rolling hills.
Yeah, and the castle is on an island in the middle, so incredibly, yes, isolated. Yeah. The castle is now in ruins.
It is, yeah, in ruins, yes, but yeah, you can access it. I think it's handled by Historic Environment Scotland, and you can access the ruins by boat, which is a really fun experience in itself. And then it's just really wonderful to sort of walk around this place where sort of Mary and her women would have walked. And also there are some red squirrels, there are sort of blankets of heather. It's a very, it's a great day trip. I would recommend it.
So as a final question, it's been so lovely to read a book which puts a historical woman at its centre and tries to tell her story in a new way to draw attention to these gaps in history. I saw it as an heir to books like Pat Barker's The Silence of the Girls or even Lauren Groff's Matrix. And I just wanted to ask, it's quite a general question, I suppose, but what do you think about this trend of literature which attempts to put women's experiences, historical or otherwise, at its centre?
Yeah, I think, as I said before, I think for a long time there's been the erasure of women's stories or else the skewed representations of them. I think with your book about Margaret Cavendish, I know that she was much aligned for most of her life and then by subsequent historians for many centuries. And I think Mary Stuart is sort of a similar figure. I think there are parallels there. And I think it can only be a good thing that these stories are being retold with a new original perspective, and just as you've done with your wonderful biography.
Not at all. I loved yours for the diversity of voices and the diversity of characters you include. It's not just the aristocratic women. It's real attention paid to everyone who was involved with it. Thank you so much. And thank you so much to Flora Carr and to Intelligence Squared. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Intelligence Squared. This episode was produced by Leila Ishmael and edited by Tom Hall. If you want to keep up with everything going on at Intelligence Squared, sign up to the newsletter. Head over to intelligencesquared.com to get the heads up on all our live events coming up. And members can also peruse over 20 years of our back catalogue featuring some of the world's great minds. That's all over at intelligencesquared.com.